Side two.
Two, a second interview of Ernest Light, February the 13th, 1998. Well, Ernie, would you please continue and talk about...
I just want to track a little bit back to Auschwitz. While I was there, and we were all standing, and somebody, I don't know how, got a hold on a cigarette. Somebody was smoking there. And I had there a gentleman with me who was from Hungary. He was middle-aged, probably in the 40s, I call him middle-aged. And he must have been a very heavy smoker. And he saw that man smoke. He says, you know, Hungary had a lot of Jews who were so-called Kisbirtokos, or they were so-called farmers. They didn't work their work, I mean, take care of the farm themselves, but they had other people, especially non-Jews, who used work. He told the guy, he says, give me one cigarette, I'll give you half of my farm when the war ends, and he come back. That, I always think, how addictive cigarettes really are. He didn't care about food or anything, just about a cigarette. And I could always see them, I couldn't understand how a person can crave so much for something, but it must be this tremendous power the cigarette had on some people. Anyhow, we arrived at Auschwitz the following morning. We went out to work in the ghetto.
You arrived to Poland? I
arrived to Warsaw, yes. Now, it's for those who don't know, in end of May. And those who don't know the history,
1944.
Those who don't know the history of Warsaw, Warsaw had one of the largest ghettos in Europe. They ground up, I think they started that in 1941. By 1943, there were actually in the beginning close to 500,000 Jews there, squeezed in that ghetto. A lot of them died, and a lot of those were after they deported to Treblinka, to Majdanek. And there they were gassed. And but towards 1944, the spring of 1944, there was very few of them left. And they found out where they're being taken. And they said, might as well die here, rather die here than to be carried away there, killed there. And they revolted. It was during Passover time in 1943. And actually, they put up a fight. That was the first time that Jews anywhere revolted against the Germans. Of course, the power, German power, was overwhelming. They came and they destroyed the ghetto with them. Some of them survived, some escaped, and some were taken away to different camps after that. And our job, when we came there, was to liquidate the ghetto, to salvage anything that has any kind of value, and then we loaded these things to freight cars and send it back to Germany. Now, other small items that the Germans didn't use, German, Polish peasants or Polish people used to come with their wagons and pick up and pay to the Germans for that. While we were there, there were a lot of people who were working in the ghetto. They had to clean up everywhere, and they were looking at the bunkers everywhere. Some of them found people, dead people, whole families together. They were there, and they were looking always for all kinds of valuables. I, again, was one of those who was selected, about 20 of us, the third day or so. And they told us not to go back to the work to the ghetto, but assembly in a different spot, and we are going somewhere else. We assembled, and suddenly in the morning, a military truck came in and told us they had a canopy over it. He says, jump in, and we jumped in, and we went for a ride. And again, the canopy was, we were covered again, covered by canopy, and just traveled. We arrived. We arrived to the SS headquarters of Warsaw, and we became so-called the maintenance men. Cut the grass, any kind of work that could be done, this was our job. I think we had it better, but the work wasn't as difficult, I think easier, and sometimes you got some leftovers too, than the rest of the people. And another thing we had there, we had an amplifier in the center of the court for the German soldiers, like the radio, they could listen to music, listen to the news. And every day was the same routine. The morning left, and the evening came back. Our diet consisted of, in the morning you got up, you got some black coffee, then you went out to work, and you worked until the evening. In the evening you returned back, you got a slice of bread and soup, and that is, was all what there was to it. And during that period, while we were in Warsaw, there used to be every second or third week a so-called a selection, and you, every Sunday, you used to take off your shirt, and anybody was a Muslim. A Muslim was a person who had hardly anything left, any meat on him. Only thing he had left is skin and bone. Those were selected, and they were always after that sent back to Auschwitz to get rid of them. And that was the routine all the time. So every selection, always we lost somebody else. And while I was working there, and right the first to the second week already, in June, while we were listening there, the radio was on, and there was an announcement on the radio: Allied forces tried to land in France. Of course, we inflicted heavy casualties, and we repelled them. I didn't know what that day was called that time, but now I know it's called D-Day. And that was my introduction to D-Day. And I came back to the barracks, I told my friends not to worry. I know this is not true, this is all propaganda. The Allies landed, and very soon the war will be over. Unfortunately, the war didn't end, and life kept on going on the same way every day. Some people either died natural death, and a lot of them were taken back, but we were still staying there, all of us. We were there over 3,000. But towards the end of July, in the night time, we could hear already machine guns, especially artillery. The Russian front was getting closer and closer to Warsaw. By July 28th or something like that it was, they told us to get ready. Tomorrow we are leaving Warsaw. Instead of leaving us there, they decided, no, they're taking you away. And they announced, make announcement in the evening, all older people, sick people, not to worry. If you cannot walk, you just stay back at the barracks. We'll transport you after that to catch up with the rest of them. The morning is, we got up and told us to assemble. We assembled, they counted us, and I counted again, and they gave us some kind of conserves, fish, all kinds of things to eat. And we started to walk, and I think must have been a Sunday, because a lot of Poles were at home, standing on the balconies and watching us walk. While we were marching to Warsaw, you could hear voices, and they said, good for you, Jews, you deserve it. Now you're finding out what life is, and all kinds of very much a tremendous amount of derogatory remarks. But there were other remarks also. Some of the folks said, don't worry, the Russians are from all fronts, the war will end soon and everything will be all right. Some, I remember much more those people, and I think these people gave me more somehow hope that there is a chance to survive. There's still some humanity left there. Because for a while, I didn't think that there is a chance for any at all. And as we kept on walking, and anybody couldn't keep pace, they were right away disposed of, and it got very hot. It was July, and we finally reached the river, as we arrived close to that river. And there was a bridge, the SS set up their machine guns, and they let us go into the water. And the water, of course, there were cows and horses, the water was murky, it didn't make anything, and it was a warm water, but it was a good feeling just to quench your thirst a little bit and drink something. And while we were in the water there, a friend of mine actually he was with me all the time. A nice kid, one of the nicest, was deaf and dumb. And the German suddenly gave the orders, Rauch, schnell, hart, fest. I don't know, we overlooked them, and their other people either couldn't make it fast enough. They were all mowed down, and that's the first time I saw a Red River. It's the first time I witnessed killing. And as we came out, and we started to walk again, and we were walking, and finally, towards the evening, we wound up in an open field, big place, because we started out 3,200, over 3,200 from Warsaw, and we settled there for the night, surrounded with dogs, with German soldiers, and the only tools we had with us was a spoon and a mess kit, and we were still thirsty. So what we did, we started to dig in the ground, keep on digging with the hands, spoons. Suddenly the water appeared. Didn't dig it too far. Probably the water level, the table water level must have been very, very low, or high, as you tell me. And of course the water was very murky and everything, but you waited an hour or so, suddenly it cleared up and we drank, so at least we had enough water to drink. Next morning, started out the same thing, to keep on going again. March again, and march again, the third day and the fourth day. So we arrived finally to our destination. We arrived at a place called Kutno. There was a railroad station. They took us there in a railroad junction, and they settled us there to wait for the train to take us to our new destination. As we were sitting there, all that period while we were walking was hot, unbearable. Here it started to rain and pour. We had no change of clothes or anything, but the second day we were all just lice crawling all over us, everywhere and everything. And no change, and nothing, you couldn't do nothing at all about it. Finally, the rain stopped, and suddenly, the following day, after how many days we stayed there, the train pulled in again and again. They loaded us up in cattle cars, squeezed us in, as many as we could squeeze in. No room, just room, hardly room to sit down. And it was difficult without water, and you were walking, but now here we were cramped in, and closed the doors, and suddenly the thirst again. And it was the most horrible experience of my life for all of us who were in that train. Nobody will ever forget what it was. Because hunger is not pleasant, and it's not something that I wish on anybody, but thirst is something that's not undescribed. You cannot describe what it means to be thirsty. People relieve themselves when they drink. They try to do something, anything, screaming, crying, hallucinating. I remember a little kid, he was from his mother, they must have had a little farm too, because he was from around Munkács, city of Munkács. They were like taking their produce to the, what do you call it, to the market and sell it. And he hollered in hallucination, mother, don't sell the carrots so cheap, you're selling them too cheap. And I all remember this kid, what he was hollering, because he was hallucinating. And I remember another occasion, of a case for while we were there, an SS man came to a fellow who was a doctor, and he had a golden bridge of his teeth, was over his teeth. He says, give it to me, remove it. He says, no, I cannot do it. I won't give it to you. Then he shot it. So he would have been much better off if they had given it, but he would not give it to himself. So there were some, so they were traveling like that. And by the third day, people died. Took those people, the dead people, and put them in the one side or other side. Suddenly there was more room already to move around, even to stretch out. Finally we arrived at the destination, and we stopped, we came out, and I'm all dizzy. And the first thing I remember, I touched the ground and put just some dampness to my lips. And we came in, so I wound up in big barracks again, and they told us to take off our clothes, shower, disinfect it, give us clean uniforms, I still don't know, because I was so worn out, most of us, how many days we stopped there, but anyhow, the destination was Dachau. And we stayed in Dachau for a few days, and we were there, and there they didn't work or not, because we were not in condition, and suddenly orders came, we are leaving Dachau. And this time, we are assembled at a station, and as again, not cattle cars, but regular train came. And I cannot figure out why they sent a regular train and to take us to our next destination. And we got on the train. Sometimes I think maybe they didn't have enough freight cars, or they didn't want to expose to the Germans, because that was in, it was in Bavaria, to see what's going on.
How many were left by that time?
By that time, we were 3,250. We started out, we were 2,000. Better than a third of us perished on that road. And we come, and we went for a short trip. It wasn't a long trip again. It's not far from Munich. We wound up in a place called Mühldorf. And that was the camp that we wound up. That camp had, again, people working all kinds of jobs, but the majority of the people working in an underground aeroplane factory. The Germans were building an aeroplane factory there. Most of the people, I didn't work there. I worked on a warehouse, all kinds of jobs. And now there were no more selections, what used to be in Auschwitz. Those people who were just died natural death. Every morning there was a guy from Slovakia, used to come with a wagon and used to pack up, line up all the bodies every morning from every barrack and take it to a mass grave. Our food was on the same thing, the same way as it was anywhere else, but same morning, the black coffee in the evening, and then bread and some soup. And here we have a lot of Ukrainians, the so-called the Ukrainian Home Army. They were guards at the concentration camps. And these people, in certain ways, were worse than the Germans. We had some people among us. There were some French people who were not Jewish. These people used to get Red Cross packages. They were treated a little bit better than the Jews. How did they know Jews? Jews had their mark, the yellow star, and that's how they knew who was Jewish. And I remember in nighttime when we came home, if there was leftover some soup and you used to go for a second something, you rushed, maybe you could get a little bit more. And then when the Ukrainians were in charge of it, if they saw a Jew came, they just hit him and would not give it to them. They gave it to the non-Jews. Well, the Germans didn't give a darn. If it was there, they gave it. But the Ukrainians would not give that to a Jew. And I remember a thing that was always in my mind, again, I don't know why that person did what he did. While we were assembling, went out to work, before you went out to work, you had to line up in rows of 20 rows, 100 people. And the Germans were counting to account for everyone. Here, life didn't mean anything, but the numbers had to jive to be on there. When we arrived to that place, and it was open place next to a railroad, tracks, that was the Salzburg Express used to go by there. And one day, one of us just jumped out and jumped in front of the train and committed suicide. I don't know why he did it. He didn't have to do that because he would have died anyway. Whether he wanted, because he knew there were a lot of officials traveling on that train, or what, maybe to alert them, to show them what was going on. They'll never find out because he died, and that's all. From then on, they didn't let us come that close to the train to assemble. We had to assemble further on. By spring 1945, January, February, most of us became very sick with typhus. And I was one of those too. I had the typhus. I don't know how, what, there was no medication, no hospitals, no places to go. Somehow I pulled through it, and a lot of other ones too. And I only know the thing that in that period I have no memory at all about what happened, what not, what was going on. But one day I remember I woke up and I was feeling better. A little by little, I started to recuperate a little bit and was able to do something, to move around. I remember we had a German soldier, but actually he was from Holland, and we used to go out for these, like for us, we used to go out to the forest, not far away. We used to cut like bushes and stuff like that, and then we used to make baskets out of those. Now, we could sit and do not to work so hard. But by April, the Allied forces were coming closer and closer. We could see the Allied Air Force freely checking on us, seeing that they flew over us, they saw who we are, they didn't attack. And actually they had, next to us was a small airfield, but they didn't do attack that either. In nighttime the sirens came out. I remember I didn't even get out of anymore. I had no strength to get out. I was happy. I didn't care. You go, you go, you don't go, you don't. That's another day. But towards the end of April, orders came, we are evacuating this place, we are leaving because the Americans, I mean the Western forces are coming closer and closer. Instead of letting us to be liberated, they just again tell us we are leaving. But there is only one thing that was different now. My nephew, who I'll come back to him a little bit later, he was with me during that whole period, and he was just sick of typhus. And they had an infirmary that time, and all these sick people were put in that infirmary. And the trains came, they put us on the trains, and we wound up squeezed in, and we were traveling. Probably one step forward, two steps backwards, because you had to always to move, because from each side, from all sides early, the American forces were coming closer and closer. On the second day or so, suddenly we were at the railroad junction and the Allied Air Force machine gunned us. I assume that they thought that we are German soldiers, that the Germans are moving their army or something. We broke through the cattle cars, came out and they saw who we are, and they stopped shooting. The fellow next to me was killed, and mine, I had on a coat, so-called, and then through the bullet went through the shoulder, but then it didn't scratch me at all. And we tried to run after that, there was a small village there, we came, and then the so-called SS youth, Hitler youth, not SS, Hitler youth, rounded us up and took us back to the train. We got on the train, I think the following day or so. Suddenly the train stopped and didn't know what it is, and after they opened up the cattle cars, and no sign of German soldiers, nobody at all. We stepped out and we were free. I mean, we didn't know what it means to be free, we didn't know what to do or where to go. There was nobody to advise us.
Where was this? Exactly.
It was in Germany.
In Germany.
Yes. In deep in Germany. And not far from Munich. And as we came out, a group of us, I remember, started to walk. There was a highway, we kept on walking, and then we saw some farmhouses. We stopped at a farmhouse. These people, these farmers, whether they were afraid of us or they felt sorry for us, they gave us to eat and some milk to drink. And I wish they wouldn't have, but this is the worst thing that could have happened to us, because we were starved and we were having eaten for that, and this, we didn't know what that will do to us. And we walked, and towards the evening we arrived in abandoned German barracks, and we arrived there in the evening. We're all bloated, throwing up, diarrhea, every possible thing, because we were, our stomachs were not used to any kind of food. Of course, I think even if they would have told us not to eat, we could have not resisted. Our eyes could have not led us not to eat. And we stayed in those barracks for about several days, I don't know, not too long, about five, six days, because our liberation was April the 30th. And we stayed there until the 8th or the 9th of June May was B-Day. I think the 9th. And that night, when suddenly we heard a lot of shooting. And we thought to myself, oh gee, here. We thought we made it, and here the Germans are coming back. But the next morning, we go coughing, we found out the war ended, and suddenly we saw German medics, German nuns, German nurses came in there, and they started to take care of us. Those, like I was among those who didn't do a darn thing that much. They were all taking hospitals, sanatoriums, and there we were cleaned up. We were given food, and we were under medical care. Little by little, we started to recuperate. And it took a while, I know it, but you're young somehow. You recuperate somehow, pretty fast. And I remember the first thing I remember, the first day that I went out, and I went out, we were in a city called Weilheim, W-E-I-L, I think D-H-E-I-M. And as I'm there, and I saw there, big open play field in the center of the city there, and I saw American soldiers standing and playing ball. And I look up, one of them had on a big mask on his face, and a glove. I saw another one, I saw him holding a bat, and I saw some of them standing in the outfield like. And here I look, the guy throws a ball, the other one hits, and everybody runs. That was my introduction to so-called American baseball. So see, what a crazy, grown people playing such a crazy game. I had no idea. But I was always interested in sports, and I stood there for a while and watched them. Of course, when I came over to the United States, I realized there was more to it. And we, as we were staying there for a while, and we had to, all of us who wanted to return to their place of birth had to register. Those of us who came from originally from Czechoslovakia and were all registered, and then we were all told the following morning we are being taken back to Czechoslovakia. They came with about several American military trucks, and they put us on the trucks, and they took us to transport us back to Czechoslovakia. On our way back, we stopped towards the night to sleep at Garmisch, Karten, Pilsen. And I have done, this one would have a difficulties to spell it, but the idea is the Garmisch part in Pilsen is the thing is that was the headquarters or the so-called the resort for the SS and for Hitler, for all the big German, dignitaries. Imagine, I thought myself when I came there, what would they say now, and they would see us there, the Jews sleeping there in their elite headquarters. Anyhow, the second day, we were transported back to Czechoslovakia, we were transported to the city of Pilsen, because part of Czechoslovakia, the western part of Czechoslovakia, was occupied by the Allied, by the American forces. When we arrived there, of course they gave us all, actually the same time of kids what the army got, you know, for food and stuff like that. And we stayed there and they told us, this is not the place for you, because here you will not meet many people. You go to Prague. Prague is the headquarters for those people who are for the returnees. The following day we arrived to Prague, and we came to Prague, and we found out that the YMCA was the headquarters for the returnees. When we came there, they were on the walls all over, posters and people everywhere marked their names, where they could be contacted and where they are. They were all looking, everybody was looking for somebody. And the first thing when I came there and I saw that my brother, my oldest brother, Ferry, who was deported, I didn't know that he was deported, who was deported, I think, in either February or March in 1945 to Terezinstadt, he and his wife returned, and his son is the one who was with me during that whole period together in concentration camp. So after staying there in Prague for a few days, I walked in, we got some clothes there, we got so-called...
Who provided? That was provided
by UNRWA, United Nations Relief Agency. Yeah, UNRWA. UNRWA. United Nations. Yeah, there were American soldiers there who were in charge, some of them, the UNRWA vets, you know, they were seen. And they all was provided there for us, and they provided, if they needed medical care or anything, all these things were provided. Because we came really to a free country, the Czechoslovakia at that time was free. And we stayed there, as I said, for a while, and then after a few days, I knew where to go. I went by train, took a train, and went to see my brother. My brother lived in Bratislava, there was Slovakia. I came back, I met him, and his wife too. And as I came back, and that was my, I think, most horrible day in my life, when I had to tell him that I was with their son together all that period, that I don't know where he is and what happened to him. Because he was sick that time, and he stayed behind in the infirmary there, in the hospital, or what do you call it, and I came back. And I stayed with them for a while,